The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties, and a lot of those cities, believe it or not, have properties for under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first property out of state in the next 4 months, I encourage you to apply to my out-of-state coaching program. I purchased properties out of state, and it's absolutely changed my life completely. The same is possible for you too. You simply need the right information. That's all it takes. My program will provide you the hands-on support and a step-by-step process to buy that first property within 4 months. So go to outofstatemoney.com to apply today. Again, outofstatemoney.com to apply today. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 125. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you're listening to this on. Also, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. All of that takes less than 60 seconds and it actually helps us out a lot. It helps us get in front of more people. It helps us to spread this message all over the world. So I cannot wait to hear from you. And if you do leave a 5-star rating and review, I'll give you a shout out on the show and read your review for all the listeners. So I can't wait to hear from you. Thank you in advance. If you live anywhere near the LA area, I want to see you this Thursday at 6 p.m. I'm hosting a free networking event at Public School 213 downtown this Thursday, July 7th at 6 p.m. Completely free. Come hang out with me. I have a couple past guests who are coming, Marion Lee, Mark Jones II, and more. So definitely pull up. I would love to meet you. If you want to come and let me know that you're coming, text BREAD EVENT to 74121, BRED EVENT to 74121. Can't wait to see you there. I hope to see you there if you live anywhere near the LA area. Really fun episode. I know you'll get a whole lot of value out of it. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Before we get into this episode, if you haven't already, please take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this show. It'll help us go up in the rankings. It'll help us to reach more people and spread this message all over the world. And you also get a shout out if you do leave a 5-star rating and review. So I can't wait to hear from you. Very excited about this episode. We have Dave Ball out of Dallas. Dave, appreciate you jumping on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Of course, of course. So start off, introduce yourself. Let the people know who you are and what you do.
My name is David Ball. In short, I'll just say I'm a home ownership advocate. About 2020, I was just kind of sitting around on IG, scrolling through IG, you know, during the pandemic, not a lot going on. I hadn't been online probably about 4 or 5 years. And I just started to see, you know, the phone was listening to what you have to say. So you kind of see the content that you're involved in. So I started to see a lot of real estate content. And it honestly just wasn't accurate. And I was like, what if I started to put out some content that was actually accurate? Maybe folks would like it. And I started posting and things kind of took off from there. So my IG is coins and culture, the letter in it, culture. And so I post content on there just to help folks understand the home buying process. And so folks started to like it. My background is in underwriting and as a loan officer. So I kind of actually like know what I'm talking about. I'm able to get into the details as far as mortgage stuff. And so a lot of folks just kind of put high level stuff. I kind of give the example of like making a photocopy of something. Like the first photocopy is good, but then you take a photocopy, the photocopy, the photocopy, and now you're like 7 people down the line, and that 7th person hasn't actually read the mortgage guideline. And then that's where I feel like a lot of the misinformation gets out. People just regurgitate what other folks say and don't actually do their research. And so, yeah, I'm a home ownership advocate. I put out a lot of content on Instagram. Recently, about 6 months ago, I started like a YouTube channel and a podcast, House Rich, if you're watching on the YouTube channel right here, where I go a little bit more in depth on the content. But yeah, just trying to spread the good word of home ownership.
Love it. Love it. One thing you mentioned is misinformation. What is, let's just jump right into it. What's some of the misinformation that you're seeing out there that needs to be addressed regarding investing in real estate?
So I think just some of the basics as far as how you even qualify for a home and like what lenders are looking at. So I know everyone has inherent biases and all that when it comes to qualifying for a loan, but honestly, your lender is just looking at 3 things. So you control all 3 of those things when it comes to buying a home. They're looking at your credit. You have 100% control over what your credit is. You know, basically, you know, 35% of your credit score is just literally just paying your bills on time. Another 30% is credit card utilization. That's 65% of your credit score. So you have 100% control over your credit. The second part is your debt to income ratio. You control your debt to income ratio. Like your debt to income ratio is simply your monthly finance debts plus your future mortgage payment divided by your income before taxes. You control your debt to income ratio. And then the last part is funds for the down payment. And, you know, I'm not saying it's easy, but you control your ability to save for a home or purchase a home that's in the price bracket that's easier to save from. And I'll save for. And then I'll just talk about like a lot of the basics I see that are incorrect online. It's just, you know, what it costs to buy a home, like just basic down payment stuff. So here's like the definitive answer from somebody who's actually read the mortgage guidelines. So if you're looking for an FHA loan, the minimum down payment is 10%. If you have a 579 credit score, 580 and above is 3.5% for FHA. For conventional is 620. For USDA is 0%. For VA is 0%. And for NACA is 0%. Like those are the answers. I see, for whatever reason, I see a lot of different information as far as like what the minimum down payment and credit requirements are for loan programs, even though it's literally like in writing. So there shouldn't be really any debate on what is what.
Got it. And I know you're an underwriter and you also have been a loan officer. Would you say in those experiences, you were really able to zero in on what the facts actually are compared to what we might see online?
Yeah, it is. Because one thing, so being an underwriter or a loan officer, you're basically the tip of the spear. So a loan officer, honestly, there's a salesperson, but the better loan officer you are, you'll know the guidelines more. So you'll dive into the guidelines because your whole thing is to coach that client on what they need in order to buy a home so that when they're ready for the underwriting process, there aren't a bunch of obstacles or your loan is not being denied. Like when somebody actually goes under contract, excuse me, let me back up. We give somebody a pre-approval letter that says, hey, you're pre-qualified for $300,000 at 5% down. There should be no issues after that because in theory, you've verified their income, you've run their credit, you've checked that they have money to buy a home. So yeah, being a loan officer, you're a salesman, but you're also the tip of the spear when it comes to understanding mortgage guidelines. And sometimes there are people that are a little too much on the sales side than the guideline side. And that's why people get further down the line and you'll hear issues where, you know, my home buying process was terrible. It was this and that. It was bad. It's because your loan officer didn't do the proper job in the first place. And that's why I try to teach folks that you need to have, it's the biggest financial decision of your life. You should have an understanding of at least the basics. You can't just depend on some random person, maybe if you walked into Chase Bank and putting your whole financial future into their hands. I mean, they should know how to do their job, but it's your responsibility as well to understand what's going on as well. Like I said, it's the biggest financial decision of your life.
Definitely. Agreed. So for those who like are super new to this, you know, you have a lot of people you're working with when you're buying a property, whether it's investment, whether it's, you know, where you're going to live at, house hack, whatever. Mm-hmm. Where does the loan officer fall into things? Because some people say, you know, oh, I'm going to Bank of America or whatever. But where does the loan officer specifically fall into the picture?
So they're basically the first person you interact with. And so whether you're going online to like to find a lender, and when you dial that number, a loan officer is who picks up. That's why I said they're a salesperson. Their goal is to sell you on the benefits of their company. A lot of times when people call or they're looking for a mortgage, the number one thing people always ask me is what's your rate? Which that's not a great goodest question as folks seem to think it is, because literally a loan officer can tell you any rate that you want to hear, and they're right. As I'll say, as a loan officer, maybe one out of 10 times when someone asks me about what your rates are, they ask me like what the points are. And so if you know what points are basically prepaid interest. And so let's say like right now the market rate is a 5.000. A loan officer can quote you a 4.500 to win your business. And that would be accurate. If you don't ask for like what points are associated with that interest rate, you may get hooked into like a bad deal because you don't understand that like that interest rate is being brought down with points. But yeah, the loan officer is basically they're the tip of the spear. They're the first person you interact with in the sales pipeline when it comes to getting a mortgage.
And how does somebody find the right loan officer?
So I would say by doing your research. So there are a couple of questions I always recommend you asking your loan officer. Is one, how long you've been in the business? There's no right answer there. You know, someone being in the business for 20 years or someone being in the business for 1 year, that's not bad. Obviously, the person that's been there 20 years probably has a little bit more experience, but it gives you an idea of kind of who you're working with. Then two, I can ask them, what loan programs do you specialize in? Because everyone's going to tell you they work with all loan programs, but different loan programs have different parameters. So I'll give an example. As a loan officer for five years, I had access to USDA loans, but I never did a single USDA loan. So if you were looking to have a USDA loan done, I was not the person for you. But I'm also not going to say, hey, I'm not going to say, hey, go to someone else. I'm going to try to figure it out as we go along. But you should ask them what loan programs they specialize in. All loan officers do conventional loans, but all loan officers do not know the guidelines when it comes to FHA, USDA, and VA. So if you're looking at one of those, USDA, VA, or FHA, you probably want to work with a loan officer that's very specific. Knows kind of can get in the weeds with those details. Three, you should ask them, like, what are your working hours? So some loan officers just literally work 9 to 5. And it's either because they're in a call center and they only have access to the customers 9 to 5 because you have to call them on the phone. Or sometimes they're very seasoned veterans. They're like, hey, I put in the work. I used to take calls on Saturdays, Sundays, and all that, but I got my established clientele base and I'm just working 9 to 5, but that works for you great. If it doesn't, hey, I got a big book of business. I'm all good. And so you want to make sure that you know their working hours, because you know, statistically, you're going to be looking for homes on Saturdays and Sundays or after hours if you work a 9 to 5 like the majority of America does. And if that's not when they're available, they're not the loan officer for you, no matter how smart they are. And then I just ask them just basically how much time do they have to explain to you the basics? Because like I said, going back to that seasoned like loan officer, sometimes they just want to deal with people that know what they're doing. Sometimes you have loan officers that are actually going to break down the guidelines and stuff for you. So you really want to make sure you're interviewing that loan officer to make sure they're a good fit for you. A lot of times folks just go with the first person they talk to, or they'll just go with somebody that their friend recommended.
Got you. So now, is the loan officer the person who is connecting the client to banks? Do they have a relationship with banks to get the loan products? Like how, I guess, you know, someone who's just starting out, all right, so now we know what a loan officer is, but when it comes to like getting the actual loan, when it comes to getting the money for the property, what does the loan officer do next? Like what's that connection?
Yeah. So there are two different type of lenders. There's direct lenders and they're brokers. So if you're like working with like a Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, even like Rocket Mortgage, somebody like that, those are direct lenders, meaning that when you're talking to somebody at Chase, the money is coming from Chase. They're also mortgage brokers whose job is to broker the deal. So they will shop your scenario to a bunch of different lenders. So they're not the ones bringing the money to the table, but they're shopping your scenario to a bunch of different lenders. And so there are pros and cons when it comes to direct lenders and brokers. If you ask a broker, they'll tell you the brokers are way better and faster. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. I will say this. When you work with a direct lender, like I'm just going to keep saying Chase, I used to work for Chase, so I can talk about them a little bit more in depth than other lenders. But when it comes to working with a direct lender, they're restricted to their guidelines. So if you're going to Chase, you're talking to a loan officer at Chase. Chase has certain overlays. And so like if for an FHA loan at Chase, you may need a 640 credit score. There's no wiggle room there with Chase with that 640 credit score. Either you got it or you don't. If you're talking to a broker and let's say you have a 620 credit score, or let's say you have a 600 credit score, their broker can shop you around to other different lenders that don't have overlays or restrictions. So let me jump back. So overlays are guidelines that lenders put on top of the basic requirements. So with an FHA loan, the minimum credit score, like I think I said before, is 500 with a 579 or less, 580 above is 3.5%, but lenders put actual guidelines or restrictions on top of those. And so your broker can shop you around to different investors that are able to kind of meet your guidelines. And so you may have a better chance with a broker if you have some credit challenges. But I will say that the other side of the coin is one of the benefits of working with like let's say Wells Fargo, is that they're in the news a lot for some unsavory things. But here's the thing, they're in the news a lot. One, for they have some bad policies and stuff going on. But two, they're in the news a lot because they're a big name. They're brokers that are doing a lot of unsavory or bad things as well. But mm-hmm. They don't make the headlines like a Wells Fargo or Chase will, because they're not looked at as hard because they're not as big of a group. And I point that out to say I've seen some of the worst deals ever in my life from brokers, because if you go to like Chase, everyone's going to get pretty much the same deal. But brokers, for the good side and the bad side, they have a lot more leeway. They may be able to give you a lot better deal, but if you don't know what you're doing, they can take advantage of you a lot, because there's not the same oversight. So when I go back to talking about mortgage points, when loan officers at Chase, everyone makes kind of the same commission alone. If it's a $300,000 loan, you're going to make a certain amount of basis points no matter what. If you're working with a broker, they have different commission scales, and they'll get paid off of like the fees associated with the loan. So if you don't know what you're looking at, so when I go back to folks being so enamored with interest rates, so if you let's say you have like a 5.00 interest rate, and that's all you're focused on and not the points, that broker can tack on certain like broker fees and points and all that on top of that, and they'll make more money off of those fees, and that's how they'll get more commission is by tacking like more fees onto the loan. And to be clear, all brokers don't do this, but I have seen some horrible deals for folks that have just been completely taken advantage of by brokers, because they know there's essentially no or very, very little oversight compared to some of the big banks.
Got it. So as far as, you mentioned people being interested in like just a 5% interest rate, but not what a broker could potentially be tacking on. Let's say somebody does notice, hey, like you're putting this fee on it. Is there anything the prospective homeowner can do about that or can say about that? Or is it just kind of is what it is?
Yeah. So the only way to accurately compare rates to know if you got a good deal or a bad deal is to get another quote. That's what I tell every single person is when folks are like, hey, is this a good quote? I'm like, you know, it's in comparison to something else. And so a lot of times like folks are scared to get their credit pulled by more than one lender, because there's this concept out here. The whole credit repair is a whole other thing where folks are so excited about credit inquiries. But here's the thing when it comes to getting your credit pulled. And you can go to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB. You go to their website and it says this. You can see this on Experian site, Equifax site, and TransUnion site as well. For a mortgage or for a car, like any credit pull within a 45-day time frame counts as one hit. So whether you go to Chase or you go to your local broker or you go to 10 other brokers, it all counts as one inquiry. It will appear on your credit report 10 times, but it only counts against your credit score as if it was one inquiry. And so literally the only way to know if you got a good deal or not is to go get more than one quote. So like if you see one lender's quote, you have 5.000 and there's, 1.5 points on it. And then you see another lender's quoting you a 5.000 and there's 0.5 points on it. You know that one deal is better than the other. That's literally the only way to compare quotes. And so just kind of real quick, if you actually have like you're under contract, you have a loan estimate, in order to actually compare quotes, you want to look at block A and block B on your loan estimate. The first one is lender fees. And the second one is lender specific fees. Whenever you compare quotes, those are the only two blocks that matter on the loan estimate when it comes to comparing fees. And also in order to compare rates, you have to be comparing the exact same interest rate. So like one lender's quoting you like a 5,000 and there's like 1.5 basis points to it. And then another one has like a 4.875 and there's like 1.9 points to it. You can't compare those rates. Ask them to quote you, ask one lender either to come up on the interest rate or to come down in the interest rate. And that's how you actually compare the points on the loan. Is you have to be looking at the exact same interest rate for each loan estimate.
Got it. Love that. And something that's apparent is it's important for people to actually read what they're signing. Like when you're buying a home, there's so much paperwork and it can be tempting to just sign, and get it over with. But it's important to know what you're looking at.
Definitely.
Literally. As simple as it sounds, like it's important to be informed and not just blindly sign stuff. So I'm glad that you're breaking down what people should be looking at when they're reviewing these documents.
Yeah, most definitely. So like if you're looking at your closing, so the first thing you'll probably see from lenders, like a closing cost worksheet. I always tell folks, those are cool to look at. They're just like kind of like initial quote of what the lender is giving you. But they honestly don't matter. The only thing that really matters is your loan estimate. Because if you go to a lender 2 months ago and they quote you one interest rate, rates have shifted. I mean, in the last 2 months, I think rates have gone up almost like 2 points. And so the initial closing cost worksheet the lender gives you honestly doesn't really matter. What you really want to look at is your loan estimate when it comes to the mortgage process, because cost worksheets are different per lender. Your loan estimate is a standard form that every lender has to use. And it allows you to compare quotes. So yeah, when you sign a doc, when you go to closing, there's going to be a packet that's probably like 100 pages. I guess in theory, you should sort of read them all. Like I said, well, you have the right to leave them all, but definitely read like the first like 5 pages, because that's where it tells you like what your payment is, your rate is, the points. It tells you how much interest you're paying. And honestly, everything that's super important is like in big bold letters as well. But yeah, definitely if you don't feel comfortable with anything you're signing, you know, have your lender, have the person that taught a company explain to you. It's literally their job to do so.
Definitely. Definitely. And I know you're currently an underwriter, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yes. Can you explain what an underwriter does and where that falls into play within the home buying process?
Yeah. So an underwriter's job is to evaluate the credit and collateral for the property. And so I'll walk through the kind of the home buying process. So you're looking online, you're looking for a lender. So most people actually start with a realtor when it comes to the home buying process. I always recommend starting with a lender, because if you don't have any money, you can't buy the home. So in my opinion, you need to talk to a lender first and get your pre-qualification letter or your pre-approval letter. Once you have your pre-approval letter, you want to reach out to a realtor, because any realtor that's decent is not going to work with you if you don't have some sort of pre-approval letter, because it's literally a waste of their time. They get paid when the loan closes. So they want to make sure that you're qualified to be looking at homes in the price bracket that you think you're qualified to look in. And so then you go looking for homes, then you find a home. And then once you put in an offer, your offer gets accepted. In this market, probably not the first home, but you know, hopefully the first home, your offer gets accepted. And then you go under contract. And so at that point, hopefully the loan officer gave you a decent pre-approval. And then they collect your documents all again, because your documents typically are good for about 60 days. So they'll recollect like your pay stubs, your most recent bank statements. Your credit report is typically good for 120 days. So they probably won't run your credit again if it hasn't been 120 days. And then your file gets submitted to underwriting. So an underwriter's job is to know the guidelines front and back and make sure that you're good to go for the loan. So they do the same thing the loan officer does, but they just know the guidelines a lot better, because they're in the books. They're evaluating your income, making sure you have the funds. They're evaluating your credit, making sure there's nothing bad in your credit report. So you can actually have an appropriate credit score, but there could be something in your credit report that may get you denied for whatever reason. And then the other two parts of the underwriting process that are evaluating the collateral as well. So you'll get an appraisal done on the home. And so let's say like your offer is like $300,000 on the home. And so with the appraisal, a lender can only lend you the lower of the sales price or the appraised price. And so, you know, they're making sure that the appraisal comes in, you know, at or above the sales price. If not, you got to go back to the seller and figure things out or pay out of pocket. And they're making sure there's no issues with the property as well. So like an appraiser, their job is not to evaluate any structural or safety issue with the property, but they will like look at the obvious. Like if your roof's messed up, if there's cracks in the ceiling or foundation, they'll note that on the appraisal. And so that's part of like evaluating the collateral too. It's not just the price from the underwriting standpoint. And then the last point is they're evaluating the title basically. So that's what the underwriter, really the title company does it. The underwriter just looks at it and gives a thumbs up, but they're making sure that, you know, the person that's selling the home actually owns the home. There's no liens on the home that needs to be cleared. But in real short, their job is just to make sure that you are abiding by the actual underwriting guidelines. They're the ones that are actually like going through the pages and reading the regulations and all that, because they're literally hundreds of pages. Your loan officer doesn't have time to do all that. So
gotcha. So that's your day to day, just reading through a bunch of paperwork.
Yeah. So yeah. Most files, I'd say 80-70% of files, you kind of know what's what. But you will go in there and but I mean, once too, underwriters are wrong too. And so that's another reason it's important to have a loan officer knows what they're doing, because underwriters can be wrong. So the underwriters are the last line of defense. If they say you're wrong and you're not wrong, but your loan officer doesn't speak up and say, hey, I think this is wrong, a loan could be denied because of that. But they're the kind of like the last line of defense. So I would say this, your loan officer works for the company. Your lender kind of works for you. Their job is to help frame your loan to get it pushed through.
Gotcha.
Do you really think investing in real estate is too expensive? Well, you wrong about that. Presenting a beginner's guide to buying your first out-of-state property, a Black Real Estate Dialogue course. That's right, it's the new course presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue, teaching you how to develop the investor's mindset, the advantages of investing out of state, getting your finances in order, finding the right location, assembling your team, creating financing strategies, how to find and analyze properties, how to find tenants, real-life case studies, and so much more in bonus content. Oh yeah, did we mention you have lifetime access? My goodness. If you have dreams of buying a property out of state but have no idea where to start, well, this is the guide for you. Learn the tips from someone with firsthand experience.
Gotcha. So we got a lot of gems so far on, you know, specifics of the home buying process, working with a loan officer, what an underwriter does. So now I want to transition to, where does somebody start? There's so much information out there, right, regarding buying a property. There's so many ways to do it. But I want to hear from you, like, what are your recommendations for someone who's buying a property for the first time, whether that be an investment property, whether that be just a home for them and their family? Like, what program should they look at? And generally, what should that person be doing?
So literally, the first thing anyone should do when buying a home is say, what is my current living expense? And so if you're, just let's make the number super easy. So if you're renting a home, let's say you're renting for $1,000 a month. I always ask folks, because here's what happens. Most folks have no idea, like, what their budget is. And so if you're renting for $1,000 a month, I always ask folks, okay, is $1,000 a month good for a monthly mortgage payment? And so if the answer is $1,000 is a little bit too tight on the rent, okay, you know, is $900 good? Or if $1,000, you're fine with that, you could go up. Let's say, oh yeah, maybe I can go up to $1,500. Okay, so now what you need to do is figure out what a mortgage payment is that equates to $1,500 a month. And so the way you do that is, you literally just go to Google, type in the words mortgage calculator, and you just have to play around with the numbers until you get a principal and interest payment that's roughly about, let's say, roughly about $1,000. And so taxes and insurance will vary, obviously, based on where you're from. But you'll go to Google and just find out what monthly payment gets you about $1,000. And then so let's say it's like a $200,000 home. So then what you want to do is go to like realtor.com or some website that has homes and start looking at $200,000 homes and click on a couple of homes. And then what you want to do is scroll down and see what the property taxes are on those properties. And so let's say the property taxes on a $200,000 home are $2,400 a year. So now you know, okay, my taxes are going to be $200 a month. So you got your $1,000 a month principal interest payment plus $200. So now we know we're at $1,200 a month. Then you want to kind of figure out what your insurance is. That's a little bit harder. In Texas, I just tell folks to add about $150 to your insurance, but you may want to talk to an insurance person to actually figure that out in your area. And so now we've got $1,000 plus $200 plus $150. We're at $1,350. So we know that a $200,000 home is going to give us a mortgage payment of about $1,350. So now we know for our budget is all the way up to $1,500. We may be able to look at homes that are like $225. And so that's literally the first step you need to take. And then, so now that you figured out that your budget's about, you can qualify or you can afford a home that's about $200 to $225. What you want to do is say, hey, do I want to live in a neighborhood with homes that are $200,000 to $225,000? If the answer is no, you know, maybe you need to wait, maybe you need to get your income up or something like that too. Or maybe you need to, at that point, maybe you need to increase your budget to go a little bit higher. And so once you got to figure out what price range you're comfortable in, that's when you now want to start figuring out, okay, now how much money do I need to save to buy this home? And so if it's a $200,000 home, if you're like, say, if you're looking at FHA, 3.5% down, that's, you need to save about $7,000. If you're looking at a conventional loan, 3% down, that's $6,000. And then you want to add in your closing costs as well. If you're in the state of Texas, I'll tell you your closing costs are about 3.5% of the purchase price. And so if we're in Texas and I'm looking at a $200,000 home, okay, I'm going to use a conventional loan, that's 6%, that's 3% down, $6,000 plus $7,500. Now I know I need to save $13,500 to purchase this home. So now I need to look at my bank account. Do I have $13,500 in my bank account? The answer is yes, you're probably good. If the answer is no, now you need to put together a budget or a savings plan in order to get to that number. And so you need to actually put together a budget, because now you need to figure out how many months it's going to take you to get to that number in the first place. And so those are like your first two steps. Step three is like, what in the world is my credit score? And so like a general idea is like, your banking app will give you like a general idea of your credit score, but those are like, that's like a Vantage 3 score model. And so typically those are like 20 to 60 points higher than where you are. What your lender actually uses is a FICO 2, 4, and 5 model. The ways to get that is you can either get your credit pulled by a lender to figure that out. Don't be scared to get your credit pulled. I mean, it may hit you like 4 to 5 points. It's honestly, it's not a big deal. Credit repair people make it seem out to be a bigger deal, so they can sell you stuff, but it's not a big deal. Or right. You can go like to, oh, sorry, go ahead. So,
you said credit repair people. I know I see some of your content regarding credit. You mind if we segue to that and then get back to the rest of the process?
Oh yeah. So I can definitely go on a little rant if you want to about credit. here's the thing about like credit repair and credit inquiries. Well, I'll talk about. So let me break down how your credit score works. So your FICO score is based on 850 points. 300 of those points are just free for having a credit profile. And so if you have like a credit profile for like 6 months, you start out with a 300 credit score. So whenever you see like the charts where it's like, hey, 35% payment history, 30% credit utilization, 50% length of credit history, 10% new credit, 10% credit mix, those percentages are based off those 550 points, not your 850 points for your FICO score. And so I like to point that out because 35% of 550 is, I want to say, 192 points, which is your payment history. 30% of 550, which is your credit utilization, is 165.2 points, I think. Y'all can figure out the math if you got a computer and your list or calculator. But anyways, those two numbers add up to 350 points, right? And so once again, you have 300 free points. Those two items add up to roughly 650 points. And so that's why I tell folks, inquiries don't matter. They're 10% of your score, literally only 55 points. New credit mix, it really doesn't matter for a mortgage. If you got the score, you got a score, but that's only 55 points. And then length of credit history is 82.5 points. And that's just really how long you've had like a card. It's not much you can do about that. I mean, I guess you could add it as authorized user if you want to, but let me jump into the inquiry part. So here's why your inquiries don't really matter at all. So what an inquiry is, it's literally just saying that somebody inquired about offering you credit. It's not that they offer you credit, it's that somebody inquired about offering you credit, or you had someone inquire about getting credit, however you want to look at it. And so they only count, like an inquiry only counts for about 5 points on your credit score. And so what happens is like after like 3 months, inquiries, they may impact your credit score by about 1 point. The reason for that is because let's say you go to the car dealership and you have an inquiry, you go to the Benz dealership, because you want to buy a car, Jim's Mercedes or whatever. And so there'll be an inquiry on your car for Jim's Mercedes in the first month, because the credit report doesn't know if you got the car or not. But after month two, and definitely after month three, if you got the car, there'll now be a car payment on your credit report from Jim's Mercedes. If after 3 months there's no car payment on your credit report, that means you didn't get the car. And so that's why inquiries really only matter in the first 3 months, because the credit system doesn't know what happened with that interaction. After like a year, they don't matter at all. And then definitely after 2 years, they literally have no impact on your credit score. But I see folks like selling inquiry removal kits and all this stuff online. Here's how you get an inquiry removed. I have a video on my YouTube channel. This is literally all you do. And we're going to assume that it's not your inquiry for purposes of this conversation. But you literally just call the lender and say, hey, there's an inquiry on my credit report for Jim's Mercedes. I did not authorize this credit pull. Can you please remove it? And so they'll either do one or two things that happen. They'll say, okay, sorry, but they'll remove it. Or they won't remove it. Those are only two things that happen. A lot of times they'll remove it because there's like no evidence that you actually got the inquiry, unless like the dealer makes you sign something. And so if the dealer has evidence that you signed something, that means it's your inquiry. So I mean, mm-hmm. You shouldn't be trying to get inquiries removed that aren't yours. But if it wasn't your inquiry, or they don't have proof that you signed it, like they'll remove it, or they'll just ignore you. And so if they ignore you, then what you do is you reach out to TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax, and say the exact same thing, or you can send them a letter basically saying that there's an unauthorized inquiry on your credit report. And so now what TransUnion, Experian, Equifax do is now they reach out to James Mercedes and say, hey, Dave is saying that he did not have that this inquiry is not his. It was unauthorized. Please provide proof that he inquired about this item. And so if they don't have any proof, like it gets removed. Like that's literally all that happens. And so like it's always baffling to me where I see like people selling like these inquiry removal kits for like $40, $50, $9.99 or whatever online. When literally that's all you need to do to get an inquiry removed if it's legitimately not yours. Honestly, if it is yours, they don't have any evidence. That's how you get it removed too. So, but that's the whole inquiry removal hack that people are selling to you. So,
gotcha. All right, back to the home buying step. So, credit was the last one. What's next?
And so let me jump into or go into credit a little bit more. So, like I said, you can get your credit score, the actual FICO 2, 4, and 5 from myfico.com, or like I said, you can use your bank app. It's probably like 40 to 60 points too high. But if you use your bank app, what you want to do is you want to go to annualcreditreport.com and just pull a free copy of your credit report. So it won't show you your credit score, but what it'll show you is the derogatory items on your credit report. And so if you're looking at your banking app and you're like, hey, my banking app says I have a 740 credit score, but you're looking at the annualcreditreport.com and you're seeing like a bunch of derogatory events, you probably don't got a 740 credit score. But if you're looking at the 740 and there's nothing derogatory on your credit report, you probably do have a pretty good credit score. But you always want to go to annualcreditreport.com and check it out, because it will, like I said, it'll show you the derogatory items in your credit report. And you want to find those out before you talk to a lender or start the home buyer process, because if it's legitimately not yours, at that point, it gives you time to actually dispute what's on your credit report and kind of figure that process out, because you don't want to go through the dispute process during the loan process, because that's just going to hold up your qualification, basically. Because if you're disputing something's in your credit report, the lender's just like, okay, I don't know who's right, the credit bureaus or you. You two got to iron that out before we can move forward. And so so the first thing, just to recap, you want to figure out what your budget is, figure out how much money you need, and figure out your credit. And so those are the first things you need to do internally with yourself before you even think about talking to somebody else. And then, in my opinion, like I say, you always want to reach out to a lender first, because the money is what matters. Like if you don't got the money, you can buy a home without a realtor. You can't buy a home without the money. I don't recommend buying a home without a realtor, but you can if you kind of want to. And then so you want to get your pre-qual, and then you want to do the same thing. Like I talked about interviewing your lender, you want to interview that realtor as well. Even if your friend, you know, they loved Chris or Jane or whoever the realtor was, maybe they worked out well with them. That doesn't mean necessarily they'll work good with you. So like some questions you probably want to ask your realtor are kind of the same question, you know, how long you've been in the business. One is, what areas do you specialize in? So realtors will always say, hey, I can go anywhere. Like here in Dallas, they'd be like, yeah, I cover the whole Dallas-Fort Worth market. There's a huge difference between Dallas and Fort Worth. There's a huge difference between Dallas and like Duncanville and Frisco. I'm probably getting the weeds. If you're not from Dallas, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But just think about your city. You know, you can go 10 miles and there's a huge difference between like, you know, the cities and what's going on there. And so that's super important too, because especially in like today's market, you probably want a realtor that's plugged into the neighborhood you're looking in, because that's a realtor who may be able to find you like off market deals or has good relationships with the other realtors that are familiar with that area. Cause that's what will help your deal get kind of pushed to the top. Like if there are 10, 20 offers on a home, let's say the home was going for, I don't know, $300,000, you offered 320, and there are a bunch of offers between like 315 and 325. Like the realtor, the relationship with the realtor and the other realtor being able to co-sign that your realtor is a good realtor and is familiar with that area and be able to close deals, that's what can help push your offer to the top. I would say also you want to ask that realtor, are they full-time or part-time? Now, I think maybe like 80% or what is it, like 20% of the realtors do like 80% of the deals or something like that. So most realtors honestly aren't, and it's not a bad thing, but most realtors aren't doing business. I mean, I know, because I've looked into it, I know here in Texas it costs $300 to get a real estate license. I mean, I thought about just getting my license during the 2020, 2021 time when everything was just going so wild. I was like, hey, I don't know, somebody may reach out to me on IG and I can sell them a home. But yeah, it's $300 to get a license. So all realtors aren't moving units. And so you want to make sure you want to ask them, you know, are they full-time or part-time? And being part-time is not a bad thing. You know, customer service is not better or worse. Or that person's customer service isn't better or worse just because they, you know, they may work at a job between 9 to 5. But what you do want to ask them is if they're part-time, like, are they a part of a team? Because let's say, hey, you need to, let's say your schedule, you're off between 9 and 5, you work nights. You want to make sure that there's somebody who can go look at home with you at noon or something like that. And maybe it's one of their teammates. And so you want to make sure that they are part of a team. They have other people available to show you listings. And I'd say, so I talked about areas, not always that kind of ask them too, you know, how many deals do you typically close a month as well. So that's something that you may want to know with that, may want to know about that realtor as well. But you want to make sure that you're interviewing your lender and your realtor. Don't just run with the first person that you talk to.
Love it.
Are you looking for a community of like-minded individuals and access to experts in real estate? Yeah. Are you interested in real estate but need more support and guidance?
You know who it is.
The Black Real Estate Dialogue presents the Real Estate Investing Community. No matter how much or how little real estate experience you have, we've created a community for you because your perspective is important. All right, tell me, where's the number one place where you can do Q&A with experienced guest speakers 2 times per month? How about unlimited access to past guest speakers' recordings? What about a private Slack channel to engage in daily discussion with everybody in the community to share resources and support each other? Head on over to blackrealestatedialogue.com. That's blackrealestatedialogue.com. It's the real estate investing community presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Come join us today.
Love it, love it. And I know you're also a veteran. Thanks for your service. You were in the Navy, right?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Got it. How long did you serve?
I was for six years.
Wow. Where did you travel around a lot? Like where did you end up landing throughout your tenure?
Yeah, so I kind of got what I call like lucky during my time frame. So how it works in the Navy is when you get in, your first tour is like sea duty. And then you go to shore duty after that. And so actually when I first got into the Navy, my ship was actually on deployment. And so they deployed like the first week I was there. And so we went over to like the Mediterranean. And so I've been to probably like 20, 25 different countries, been on two deployments. During my 6 years in the Navy. And so My first 2 years, I actually went on two deployments. The first 2.5 years, and then the last 3 or so years, I went to this aircraft carrier. It was actually the George H.W. Bush. It was the newest commissioned aircraft carrier in the Navy at the time. But that thing just never got underway. Like it literally never got underway in the 3 months I was there. So it was just like a floating office building. But I was lucky enough to go on two deployments my first 2 years, and deployments where we actually like went to a bunch of different countries. They're more like NATO operations, diplomatic missions. Some folks go on deployment, they just sit in the Persian Gulf for like 6 months. So that's why I say I got lucky. I went to go on two pretty cool deployments.
Awesome. Did you get to use any of like the, did you get to use the VA loan at all?
Man, so no. And so I bought my, so I'll tell you about my first home. And so when I got out of college, I was like, yeah, so when I got out of college, my parents suggested to me that I should purchase a home. And so I was like, okay, that makes sense. You know, it's yeah, this makes sense. Purchase a home, and so I went to go. Yeah, so I went to go. So that's, let me jump back. So that's kind of one of the reasons I became a loan officer. Like looking back at my first time home buy experience, because I don't remember anything. I don't remember any of it at all. Like I don't know what loan program I used, but I'm almost positive I didn't use a VA loan because I remember my parents saying that, you know, hey, so I went to the U.S. Naval Academy, so I got to go to college for free. Or not free, I guess I had to pay with the service in the military. But my parents were like, hey, we're going to help you with the down payment on your first home. And so based on remember them saying that, I'm pretty sure, well, I know I didn't use the VA loan because I still have my VA loan eligibility, but they helped me on the down payment for my first home. But Back to the question of, I've never used my VA loan or VA benefits because I think the first lender I talked to didn't even suggest that we use it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, I would have been able to use the VA loan on my first home. And so, the first home I bought was a condo. It was a two-bedroom condo. Ended up like house hacking with another roommate. And then the next home I tried to use a VA loan because I was finally aware of the VA loan at that point. But it was another condo. And so for whatever reason, a lot of condos aren't VA certified. And so I've just bought like three condos in my home buying career, and none of them have been VA eligible. And then the last home, the home I'm in right now, I tried to use my VA loan again, but I couldn't qualify for the home by myself. And so I had a fiance at the time. And so one weird thing about the VA loan is if you want to add a non-spouse to the VA loan, the down payment jumps from 0% to 25% for some reason.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, so I ended up using what do I have in this home? So yeah, I ended up using an FHA loan on this home I'm in now. But yeah, I've never actually used my VA loan in four properties. So yeah. So I guess it's still out there waiting for me.
Definitely. Did you end up selling the rest of the other condos as you moved?
No, so I still have two other condos. I sold one condo. So I have a condo in what was that place called? Maryland, one in Virginia, and then I had one here in Dallas, the most recent one that I sold. So sold one of them. So
nice. Do you self-manage those condos?
Yeah. So here's a hack that I did. But yeah, I self-managed the condo, or I used to self-manage the condo. So, because like I said, I used to just live in the condo, and so you always hear the story about where folks are like, you know, hey, my roommate didn't know that they owned the property. Like, see that meme going around? Like that was literally my scenario. So like, my roommate didn't know the first condo I bought, I owned the condo because I had my management company was my parents. And so they would just send off the company. He would just send off the check and stuff over to like this company. But it was just my parents. They would give the money right back to me just because obviously when you're in a property, it doesn't really make sense to have anyone else manage, even if you have like a roommate in our house hacking like me. But yeah, when I moved from those areas, I got a property management company to help with things. But to me, I don't know, they don't really do anything. It seems from my perspective, because like one thing I try to do was just to get places to me that were easily manageable. Like to me, if you're, especially if you know you're going to move, like to me, get a condo or a townhome. You know, people are scared of HOA fees, but like I'm trying to think, like in 10 years, like I'm not sure that they've really. I'm trying to think if there's been any major issues in 10 years in that place. I mean, they were both brand new when I bought them, so maybe that factors in. But yeah, they really haven't done anything as far as I know to help. So in theory, I could be managing those from here in Dallas. That's something I actually need to think about. Yeah. yeah, you're paying them like 10% to.
Yeah,
I guess just in case something happens. Maybe they do stuff that I don't know about. You know, so.
It sounds like we got you in a contemplative moment. That you might be getting rid of them this summer.
yeah. That's 10% I can go into my pocket. Yeah.
That's funny, man. So I have another question for you. The market right now is very interesting. Very, very interesting. So of course, over the last year or so, appreciation has been crazy. And now there are predictions about prices dropping to some degree. And we also know interest rates have spiked recently. So what are your thoughts on the current market? Do you feel prices will drop to some degree? What are your thoughts on interest rates and just like the home buying market right now?
So when folks always say like home prices are going to drop, my question is they're going to drop down like to what? And so, you know, folks are always like, hey, the market's going to drop. The market's going to drop. I'm like, drop down to what? So I give this example here. So let's say like there's a, you have like an apple, like you want to buy apple. Let's say this apple is a dollar right now. And so I'm like, okay, the apple's a dollar. I don't have the credit and the funds to get this apple yet. And so you watch the price of the apple go up. And then when you're ready to buy the apple, it's $1.50 at that point. And you're like, huh, that apple price has gone up from a dollar, man. Maybe I want to see what's going to happen with apple prices. And then so apple prices go from $1.50 to $1.75 to $2 to $2.25. to $2.50 because you've been waiting for stuff to go down, and finally at $2.50 the market crashes. You know, I'm doing air quotes if you're listening. It crashes down to $2, and so now you buy the apple at $2. I always say, did you get a deal because the apple price went from $2.50 to $2, or did you pay more because you could have bought that apple at $1.50 instead of the $2? So, like I said, did you pay 33% more for that apple, or did you get a 20% discount on the apple? And so. Oh, that's why I always ask folks, prices are going to drop to what? So if you look at home prices the last 10 years from from 2012 to today, home prices have dropped 1 year. They dropped, I want to say 2019, and home prices went from, the average home price went from like, $385,000 to $384,000 from 2018 to 2019. That's literally the only price drop in the last 10 years. And obviously, you know what happened before, obviously know what happened in 2008, 2010. With the market crash there. But in the last year, that's literally the only time home prices have dropped. If you look at any chart of home prices, it looks just like the S&P 500. There are little ups and downs, but ultimately it goes up. And so I can't predict the future. Obviously, no one can predict the future. But statistics and everything, every piece of data said the home prices will continue to go up. And so now folks are worried about, hey, there's a recession coming up. What's going to happen with prices? Are home prices going to drop? Well, I point this out as well. During three of the last five recessions, home prices have actually gone up. And so the two recessions where home prices have gone down, you can probably guess one of those was 2008. But I point that out specifically, that recession was a direct cause of the housing market. It's not like the housing market dropped because of the recession. The housing market crash caused the recession. And reckless lending habits from lenders, and we're nowhere near what was going on in 2008. And another big thing was the supply in the 2008 2009 timeframe was way more than it was now. So we kind of know the supply is a lot less than it was. The supply right now is a lot less on average than it was in the 2008 timeframe. So like to me that this time period right now, and we folks say we're in a recession, we're going headed toward a recession. Who knows? But to me, that has no impact on what's happening with the housing market. I mean, home prices just go up. All the data says that they'll go up. So I can just look at historical data to make my assumptions for the future. As far as like interest rates, that's another thing. All we can do is look at historical data when it comes to interest rates. And so I think folks, especially folks that are kind of new to the housing market, we're just kind of like spoiled the last few years. Like 2-3% interest rates, that you can just look at that as an anomaly. Like that is not the norm. I mean, an interest rate in the fours is like a good rate historically. I mean, I think we're in like the mid fives right now, but like interest rate in the fours is like a good rate. If you're waiting on 2-3% interest rates, you're going to be waiting forever. I mean, you may be waiting another 10, 20 years to see rates in the 2-3%. And I always point out that like folks are like, oh man, I missed it. Those 2-3% rates. Rates were 2-3% for like 2 years. Like what was, I always ask was like, why didn't you buy a home? Like, it's not like rates were 2-3% for like this 2-3 month blip. It was a solid like 2 years. So I mean, if you're lying to yourself if you're saying that you're waiting for rates to go back down because you for whatever reason you didn't pull the trigger the last 2 years because you had a 2 year heads up to figure things out when it comes to your interest rate. But I mean, as far as rates, I mean, I think though, so I just said that I try not to make predictions. I just look at historical data. But to me, like, I mean, I think rates will probably, kind of tail off somewhere in the high fours to mid fives. I mean, that's where rates typically kind of hang out at. I don't see any scenario where we get back down to the 2-3% because those rates were just artificially low due to a lot of things that the Federal Reserve were doing. But I always go back to, is now a good time to buy? I always say, does it fit your budget or does it not fit your budget? That's really the right question you should be asking. And so that's why I go back to that original scenario where it's like, hey, I'm paying $1,500 for rent. Let me find out what a $1,500 mortgage will be. So a $1,500 mortgage will get you a smaller house today than it would have a year ago, based on interest rates. But that just kind of is what it is. But to me, home prices will continue to go up. They just won't go up at the speed that they were going up the last year. That was just kind of ridiculous. I think home prices would have like, 20-30% in some areas. So that was another blip. But I mean, home prices may go up 1-5% or something like that. I think they're predicted to go up this year still. And even if they flatline, or even if they go down 5%, who knows? As long as your plan is not to be in the home for 6 months, I mean, you shouldn't really care. I mean, if most folks are going to be in a home historically like 5 to 8 years anyway, so you got to be looking at the future, not what's going on next year as far as rates. If it fits your budget, my opinion, pull the trigger.
Love it. Love it. Love it. So talk to us more about Coins and Culture, about the podcast and your brand and some of the things that you're doing.
Yeah. So Coins and Calls, that's the basically the IG page that kind of started a lot of things. I just, like I said, I try to put out factual tips and make them kind of fun and creative. Because, I mean, mortgage guidelines are boring. I mean, just say, hey, credit, blah, 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 and reading credit guidelines, they're boring. So I try to make them a little bit interesting. But I always make sure that they're factual. Always make sure they're factual before anything. To me, that's the most important thing. So like, if you go through my page and if you go through like the last six posts, my thing is in the last 6 to 9 posts, you should hopefully be able to learn something by going to my page, you know, doing like those 60 second reels. And my goal is to, you know, to teach folks how to buy their first home strategically. Like you should have a plan when you buy your first home. In my opinion, like your first home, whether you want to be a landlord or not, you should always buy it from the perspective of like, what would a renter want? Like, that's what I try to teach folks, you know, try to buy your home from what would a renter want? Because chances are you're not going to be in the home 5 to 8 years, but you want the option to at least maybe rent it out and get some income from that home. You don't have to, you know, the only way to build a portfolio is not to house hack and do all this stuff. You can just buy single family homes and condos like I've done myself. And so, I got a lot of good feedback and, you know, it's starting to get good traction on my IG page. And so sometime last October, November, I was like, I don't know why it popped in my head, but I was like, hey, you know, I want to put out a lot more long form content. And so I was like, you know, let me put out like a podcast as well. And so at that point, I started like, that's when actually I came across like your podcast, because I was like researching like, you know, what podcasts are out there for really like Black millennials, like, I'd say a lot of podcasts don't pertain to like the demographic that I think you and I kind of typically work with, and they don't have like a platform to share with them, especially your platform is exclusively, you know, for you know, Black Real Estate Dialogue, you know, there and for sharing those stories to entrepreneurs. But I was like, hey, I want to go into some of these guidelines a little bit deeper. So I can share like a 30 seconds for a certain point, a 30 second reel, a 60 second reel, but I actually want to go into like house hacking. I actually want to dive into like, how do you actually house hack? Like, what are the guidelines that have to do with house hacking? Because, you know, based on the internet, you can just, you know, get a 4-unit property, buy it, live rent free and all that. But there's details. There's the FHA self-sufficiency test. You know, there's making sure your realtor knows that stuff. And so like, I'm like, okay, I wanted to actually dig into those details. So like every week on the podcast, I'll go into like one mortgage topic or guideline, whether it's house hacking, whether it's what's a HELOC, question to ask your realtor, question to ask your lender, stuff that a lot of folks, that I don't really see folks diving into from a real detailed perspective. And then also, so I'll do that on Thursday. Then like on Tuesday, I'll interview somebody and like, some sort of aspect of real estate. So I may interview somebody that does Airbnbs. I interview somebody that knows how to buy land in the metaverse. So I interview like folks in like just various like kind of different aspects of real estate, just to give you kind of something to look at if maybe you want to look at like a side hustle or something like that, or like buying a hotel or something that's not just strictly, hey, I'm going to talk to a realtor about this or that. Just kind of like real estate adjacent topics is what I kind of call it. More, you know, I have folks that host like a real estate podcast on there as well. Like I think you were like guests, I think episode like 8 or 9 you were on. So yeah. check that out as well. So,
definitely. Dave, man, this has been a dope interview. A lot of actionable steps, and I really appreciate that we're able to really dive into like some of the simple specifics of like the process. There's so much information, so many shiny objects and things like that. But I think it's always good to come back to the basics and just, you know, ground yourself in some information that is fundamental. And so for those listening, I think you'll definitely get a lot of value. If you are somebody who's early in the process and knows zero, this is a good place to start. So Dave, what does the future look like for you? What are some things you're trying to do the rest of the year, the next couple of years?
Yeah, so to me, I'm just trying to grow the brand at this point. So I mean, I like talking about like people I interview. So like one of the people I interview has to do with like a maid service, and so you know, because you're making money cleaning houses. So I started like a maid service. So if you're in Dallas, you look for a maid service, Suave the Deck Maids. You can check us out there. So I'm looking to build my cleaning company, the maid service. And I'm just looking to grow the brand House Rich. I think I actually set the name of my YouTube channel or podcast. So I'm looking to grow the brand, you know, House Rich podcast, and just looking to talk to more folks and speak to more folks and educating folks on the home buying process. So just looking to grow the brand. You know, hopefully I can turn this into a consistent income stream between the cleaning business and the real estate educating business, and just kind of take off from there. And so that's the goal, is to eventually be able to do this full time. So
love it. Love it, love it. So where can people find you again, your podcast? Where can they find that and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so on IG, you can go to just search Coins and Culture. I guess you can check it out on TikTok too. I'm trying to grow that as well. It's just the word coins, the letter N, the word culture. And so you can go to my link tree and find out all my other stuff. Or you can go to your favorite podcast platform and type in House Rich, the real estate show. And you'll find me with my hands on my hat, and I say with a sweatshirt that says "Land before the road pointed." That's my motto there. Get that house before you get that car. Or you can go to houserichshow.com, and you can get connected to everything, to me, my educational resources as well. But Coins and Culture, or just go to houserichshow.com, and you can connect with me there.
Love it. Love it. Appreciate you coming on the show, Dave. Looking forward to this episode dropping. And thank you to everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Again, if you have not already, please do leave us a 5-star rating and review. Cannot wait to hear from you. I look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bread Podcast. That's B-R-E-D Podcast. Until next time.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new, like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.